You know, those of you that know me know that I'm always falling in love. But not hardly ever with a man. But you know, I got a hold of this guy's tape, and I played that thing for myself first. And then I had the committee listen to it, and then I called him on the telephone because we wanted him. And I talked to this guy over the phone a little bit, and I loved him. And I believe you're going to do the same thing after you hear Charles L., the Arkansas Traveler. And help me to welcome to Myrtle Beach the Arkansas Traveler.
These things are kind of like a barroom spit tune. You got to get the right range on them, you make a mess. My name is Charles Lindenwood. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, family. Before I start to talk, I'd like to say something. There's a whole lot of people, you know, here that been introduced to me now, and I appreciate it. And it was such a nice introduction, Dalton. I'm kind of looking forward to what I'm going to say myself. But we sometimes get to talking so much around in AA, and we get to expecting things like that, you know, pats on the back and that. Sometimes we feel like maybe we don't deserve it. And I doubt if there's anybody in this room that's any more important than you. Every one of you. Alcoholics are kind of like milk. You never did see any grade B milk, did you? You're all grade A. Every one of you. You may have been so wrong for so long, but you're so right tonight. And I want you to know that there's a lot of love in this room. And you might as well show it. Turn to the person next to you and smile and tell them you love them. Right now, go ahead and do it. Yeah. That's nice. Sure, go ahead. That's it. Kissing's all right. Kissing's all right. Yeah. Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, we got this thing off to a good start now. Anybody miss out? Yeah. There's a man back there raised his hand. Somebody run back there and kiss him real quick. That's that Pollock that talked last night, eh? Yeah. There you are. Looky there. He getting a nice kiss. Was that a sailor? Yeah, that's who that was. See that? Down in Texas one time, I was talking, and while I was trying to get you folks over being nervous about me being up there, I got so nervous myself that I got to stammering and stuttering. There's a big old Texas boy sitting right down on the front row there where Liz is sitting. And he got out this .45 pistol and got to twirl in that tumbler. Lord, the more he done that, the more nervous I got. And I got to where I couldn't say nothing. Finally, he looked up at me and said, "Don't you worry, boy." He said, "I ain't going to do nothing to you. It's to them fellas that invited you." Now, I want you to know that the people responsible for me being here is Fred Spears, Roy McCormick, and this fellow right here, Dalton Taylor. So now we got that out of the way. I came from Arkansas by request. And I was poor. I was raised during the Depression, and it was popular to be poor. Everybody was poor. And my family overdone it. We so poor that we didn't have enough cover on cold nights like was the other night, but we did have dogs. And when it got cold, I just pulled up a dog. It gets cold in Arkansas. I have seen a three-dog night. You know, all you folks, you alcoholics and you non-alcoholics alike, you all know that you've been accused of being different, having different ideas. But I want you to know that it's according to what happens to you in your life. Like my folks, for instance, we were way back out of things, way back. We went till the roads run out and kept going. Way back in there. And I had an uncle, my drinking uncle, Uncle Ben, I took after. And Uncle Ben loved to drink, and he'd one of them drunks that had about a 6-foot stagger. That's 6 foot this way and 6 foot that way, you know. That's 12 feet. And he'd go away and come back singing. He loved to sing, and he could sing good. And his voice would trail off. That's when he'd stagger off out into the woods, you know. And then his voice would come back, and we'd listen. And one night, we was listening to Uncle Ben come home, and his voice trailed off and didn't come back. But we went out hunting him, found him. He done staggered off and fell into a hog waller, and he just went to sleep. He just laying up there beside a great big old sow, just kind of nuzzling her, you know. And he got a rubbing her on the stomach. He just rubbed up and down, and finally he said, "Martha." "How come you sew all them buttons on your nightgown?" Now, that wasn't unusual behavior. Not for Uncle Ben. Uncle Ben was all right. I had a cousin named Penny, had a baby. Everybody come to see the baby, count his fingers and toes, eyes, see if he had everything supposed to have. And everybody had come to visit this baby but Grandma. And finally, Grandma come over, and when she got over there, Cousin Penny was changing the baby's daddy. And it was laying there naked as a jaybird, kicking and cooing, you know. And Grandma got up real close, looked at it. She said, "What is it, daughter, a boy or a girl?" And Cousin Penny said, "Why, Grandma," says, "are your eyes that bad?" She said, "No, daughter, it ain't my eyes, it's my memory." I had a brother. His wife had twins, and at the time he was in jail. And in Arkansas, when there's a birth in the family, you got to name them children right away. So they said, who's going to name the children? And his wife said, well, Charlie will name them. So he got me to name the children. And when he got out of jail, he said, who named these kids? And she said, Charlie named them. He said, great, day in the morning, he's crazy. So what did he name them? She said, well, he named the little girl Denise. Oh, he said, that ain't such a bad name. So what did he name the little boy? He said, the nephew. That wasn't unusual behavior. We had a doctor down there out in Bear, Arkansas. That's in Garland County, outside of Hot Springs. One of them country doctors, nice fella. But he wasn't much of a doctor. He treated a fella for 2 years for yellow jaundice before he found out he was a Chinaman. And he was an old doctor. And he knew that he wasn't going to live forever. So he sort of broke in a new doctor, young doctor. He sent him to medical school and sponsored him all through his internship and his residency. And finally the time came when this doctor, this young doctor, was going to hang out his shingle. And this old doctor said, there's one more thing I would like to admonish you about. He said, now, you're going to make a lot of mistakes, and you'll bury some of them. But he said, don't ever admit one. No matter what kind of mistake you make, don't ever admit one. And this young doctor took due notice thereof and conducted himself accordingly. And the first customer he had when he hung out his shingle, come in there all bent over like that, said, doctor, something wrong with me. I want you to give me a good examination. Doctor told him, get up on that table. You know one of them tables is bent everywhere? Got stirrups on them. Ain't nobody could get up there by himself. He finally helped that man up on that table and gave him a good examination. Came up with his diagnoses. He said, you have got locked bowels. This man like to have hit the ceiling. He said, what do you mean locked bowels? He said, man, I've had the green apple quick step for 3 days. I had the runs for 3 days, and you tell me I got locked bowels. This young doctor said, oh, Lord, I done made the first mistake. But he's smart. You remember that doctor told him, don't admit one. He told this man, yes. He said, your bowels are locked in open position. We had a storm. We had a storm down in Arkansas, tore things up. It really tore things up. And they sent a Red Cross worker down there to sort of look things over and evaluate the damage. And when she got down there, she had a little pad, and she was writing stuff all of what was torn up and all that. Grandpa sitting on the porch, hat kind of pulled down over his eyes. And there was a rooster that the storm had blowed all its feathers off of. And Grandma, being the sweet old soul that she was, had knitted this rooster a little pair of overalls. And when he come out from under that porch with them overalls on, this Red Cross worker looked at him and said, I've seen everything now. Grandpa raised his hat up and said, no, you ain't seen everything yet. But you wait till a pullet strolls by here And that rooster takes out after that pullet on one leg trying to get them galluses down with the other. Then you've seen everything. That ain't unusual behavior. I had this uncle that never had been to town. He had to do something about taxes or something, and he went in. And they got through with their business at the courthouse, and they got hungry. And they went over and seen this little restaurant over there. And he looked at that, and he thought, now, I don't have a job to do. I don't have anything to do because I got my crops all laid by. I believe I'll go in there and see, can I get a job? They had a sign in the window, waitress wanted. He went in there and talked that man that owned that restaurant out of giving him a job as a waitress. And a first customer that come in wanted some ham cooked well and some eggs over. And he didn't go back to that little hole in the wall, you know, where they put the orders in. He went on back in the kitchen, put his arm up around that chef's shoulders. He said, see that man sitting out there? He wants a cup of black coffee and some ham cooked well and some eggs over easy. He said, now go ahead and cook that ham and mash it down in the skillet real good with that flat thing you use. And then turn it over and cook it. This chef looked at him like he was talking to some new kind of nut. And he said, I've been in this business for years, and I know what I'm doing. He said, all you have to do when you get an order like that is abbreviate. In this case, all you had to do was ham over well and eggs over easy. Oh, this hurt Uncle Seldom's feeling. And he went out there and pouted till the next customer come in. When he come in, he wanted some baked beans and some lamb. He went over that hole in the wall, stuck his head in, he said, "That." He said, "Figure that out, smarty." That ended his career in that business. But he had to come back to town not long after that, him and his wife, Aunt Puny, come back to town, and they went in this restaurant. Was one of these restaurants had signs up all around the wall. You know, soup, stew, hamburgers, hot dog. She looked at him and said, what is a hot dog? He said, I don't know. I never had one. She said, us get one, see what it's like. He said, give us two of them hot dogs, please, sir. Man brought up them hot dogs, gave her hers, gave him his. She opened her, closed it real quick. Looked up at Uncle Seldom and said, what part did you get? I kept drinking. I remember, you know, it's a funny thing when you get my age, you remember things that happened 40 years ago and go in the next room and forget what you went after. And I remember the first drink I ever had. I remember it was out in the woods, out in Fush Bottom, and I had gone down there to go hunting, and I see a wisp of smoke coming up through the trees, and I went over to see what it was. and there was a guy back there with a still running off a batch. That thump keg bumping the bump the bump. And that worm coming down and that warm white lightning dripping. Drip, 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 drip. Into one of them big jailhouse cups. You know what I mean, don't you, Bill? You know. They hold over a pint, still warm. He saw me about the same time I saw him. And he said, "Hey, come on over here. I got something for you." Well, that's what I was hunting, something. I got over there, I was 16 years old. And when I got over there, he said, "Try this." Hand me that great big cup of warm white lightning. I chug-a-lugged it. Woo! Lord, I thought I never would breathe again. I didn't faint. I just sort of wilted. It, you know, like a rag that's wet. Ain't got no starch in it. And I'm laying there on the ground, and he's looking at me like, "Wonder how long it's going to take him to die." And I'm wondering the same thing. But you know, that warm glow started in the middle and worked its way down to my toes. They got happy. Worked its way up. My hair felt good. I got up all by myself and started telling him how to run that still. I tell you the truth, at that time in my life, I thought that about a half a pint of whiskey was all the education anybody needed. And it about 30 minutes after he gave me that drink, I had shot his mule and stole a Dominica rooster from him, and he was running me out across the swamp shooting at me with a 10-gauge shotgun. And that was the end of my social drinking. I got clear home before I passed out in the backyard where we raised chickens. We raised them Rhode Island Reds. They are squirters. And I was a mess. I don't know if you ever passed out in a chicken lot or not. Don't raise your hand. But you're a mess. My mother came out in the backyard and found me. Never had seen me looking like that before. Never had seen anybody looking like that before. She took me in the house and gave me the only therapy she knew. A hot bath and a dose of castor oil and an enema. I was the cleanest drunk in Arkansas. Inside and out. And if I'd have had any sense at all, I'd have quit drinking right then. Because you know they say that alcoholics have weak stomachs. That ain't necessarily so. I could lay on my back and puke right straight up in the air, but my reflexes were slow. And I couldn't duck it. I'd be there when it come down. I can go back to Arkansas now. I was out there not too long ago talking to some cousins of mine, Art, Bart, Dart, and Fargo. And I was telling you, you know how some alcoholics complain about what a hard time they had, how tough it was. I was complaining to Art, Bart, Dart, and Fargo about what a hard time I had had, and he said, "Oh man, you ain't had no hard time." He said, "You ain't even got a southern accent. You just talk slow because you can't think no faster." He said, we got a man here, he lived right over this ridge. He got 40 acres of the poorest land in Arkansas, and he's trying to eke out a living for a little puny wife and 7 little wormy kids. And the other morning, he went out to do some plowing. He harnessed up that old mule, poor sickly mule, to a broke-down plow. And he put that bit in the ground and plowed a furrow about 20 feet. And the plow broke down, broke all the pieces, jerked that mule, and he dropped flat, graveyard dead. And he said, poor hard luck Clyde. He said he looked up at the sky. And he said, Lord, why? Why, Lord? And the sky turned black, all except one shaft of light shone right down on old hard luck Clyde. And this booming voice come from heaven. Said, Clyde, seemed like you just kind of tee me off. Lord have mercy. This upset poor hard luck Clyde something wonderful. And he went over to a neighbor's house and told him what had happened. He said, I don't know what to do. Even the Lord is mad at me. And this neighbor here said, now what you got to do, Clyde, is move to town and get on welfare. Clyde did. He moved to town, got on welfare. Them checks started coming in. And his wife kind of filled out, looked real nice. He had all them kids wormed. Everything seemed to be going fine. The welcome wagon come and run over him. And he didn't even drink. But, if you do drink, I want to tell you something. They've been announcing these tapes. The tapes that these fellows back there in the back cell, you know, there's no profit to be made in them. It costs them money. And you know those tapes, long after the meeting's over, long after the convention's over, the retreat, whatever it is, wherever those tapes are made, those things go to insane asylums. And they go to jails. And they go back in dingy bedrooms where some man that's making a 12-step call is calling on somebody that has no way in the world of hearing you talk, hearing speakers. And old Bob Polk is back there, and he does that. And he makes tapes, and he goes all over and gets tapes. He just, not long ago, borrowed a whole lot of reel-to-reel tapes of mine that I've had for years, some of them as far back as 26, 27 years. He copied all of them and gave me a copy of each one on a cassette to use as I saw fit. And I want you to know that Glenn is back there working with him, and Glenn's got the exclusive rights to the sales of tapes here at this convention, and he does the same thing. And every dime that Glenn takes in, he puts in a separate account. And when there's a surplus, he buys whatever material he uses to make these tapes, and a balance goes to some worthy institution for their tape library. And that's something that a lot of folks don't know and don't realize. But I'd like for you to be made aware of this wonderful AA service that's being performed. And if there is a tape at this convention that you'd like to hear, Go back and see Glenn. He'll be glad to let you have one for $5. You know, if you got a long-winded speaker and it takes two tapes, he can't even come out at that price because they cost more than that. Anyway, I thought I'd mention that because, see, if I mention their name, they'll mention mine. This is a selfish program. About this time, I got to the point that I got in jail. And I remember getting in jail the first time. See, when you live in a small town like I did, like North Little Rock, well, all the police know you. And whenever they see you drunk, they come up on you and they go something like, "There you are again, Charlie. Drunk, I declare. I don't know what's going to happen to you. You come from a good Christian family." Did you ever notice that all these drunks around you come from good Christian home? Ever notice that? Sometimes I wonder if that's a proper place to raise kids. Then he would give me all this lecture, and he said, "Now, for heaven's sake, go on home and stop worrying your poor mother to death." And I'd go do my drinking on some other cop's beat. Well, that went along fine for a while, but then they hired a policeman that didn't know I come from a good Christian home. In fact, he didn't know where I come from. And he didn't care where I come from. And he got me by the seat of the pants and held me up. You know how they do to keep you off balance? He was choking me is what he was doing. And got me off balance and called that wagon, and the wagon come, and they put me in the wagon, took me to the jail, put my name on the blotter, and then put me behind that door with the steel stripes on it, them bars. And it closed that door, and the police is out here, and I'm in here. And I'm thinking, I believe they got me locked up. And then I say, well, if I can't get out, they can't get in. And I seized upon this opportunity to tell them exactly what I thought of. Oh, I mean in no uncertain terms. I was referring to their ancestry. And next day, I went for the judge, and I'm standing there in front of the judge, and my legs are shaking like the wind is blowing up my pants leg, and I can't hold my head still, and the judge is looking down at me in that stern tone of voice. He said, "You're charged with being drunk. How do you plead?" I looked at him, both eyes trying to get in the same socket. I said, "Guilty. Run out." I didn't even know what fine they give me. I asked one of them other Peckerwoods. I said, "What'd they give me?" He said, 10 or 10. I said, 10 what or 10 what? He said, 10 days or $10. I didn't have no $10. I called up the grocery man that we've been buying groceries from on credit. I said, "Mr. Rice, inadvertently, they have arrested me. And it will cost $10 to get me out. Will you please, sir, come down here and bring $10 and put it on ticket?" And he did. I got out of jail on credit. First time I ever got locked up. But that was the last time that happened, because that was my mother's account. And my mother, Choctaw Indian. And when she saw that bill, she let out a war whoop. And I didn't do that no more. I never heard her let out a war whoop like that but one other time. And that was when me and a drunk was loading her washing machine on his truck when my mother came home from work. And she let out this war whoop, and it scared me, and he flat disappeared. I don't know what went with him or his truck either. But I know I never did co-mingle with any of her funds after that. But I kept getting arrested. See, before you get arrested, the police sort of hesitant about arresting you in your own hometown. But once you get arrested, you become arrestable. And from then on, them police didn't give me no consideration at all. They wouldn't even get out of the squad car. They would stop the squad car and give me that crooked finger movement. And I would walk over to the squad car and stick my head in and say, "Yeah." And he would say, "Get in." I'd say, "Get in? I ain't drunk." "Yeah, but you're going to get drunk. That's arresting you on suspicion of going to get drunk." And they used to be able to do that. I got arrested so often, in and out. In. I was doing life on the installment plan. I got to where I wanted to be smart. And it never did occur to me to stop drinking. And one day I'm going to foil the police. So I bought me a gallon of White Lightning and went down to the river and took a rowboat with two oars in it. Set my gallon of whiskey in there and rowed out into the middle of the Arkansas River. And the last thing I remember, I'm just floating around out there drinking and singing and enjoying life and woke up in jail. I asked a policeman on duty, I said, "What happened?" He said, "You got arrested." I said, "I know, but what were the circumstances?" He said, "Well," he said, "you got arrested out in the Arkansas River." I said, "How'd you get out there? Who did it?" He said, "A Coast Guard got you." I said, "What did they charge me with?" He said, "Drunken drifting." I don't think anybody has been arrested in Arkansas for drunken drifting before or since. But it stuck, and I got 10 days on the county farm. They used to keep me down in Little Rock working on trucks because I was local talent. And they knew I wouldn't run. And they let me help clean up trash on the streets, in the alleys. That went along fine till one time they put me on the garbage truck with a hangover. Woo! I added to the load. I got through that, and they let me help the dog catcher one time. And I thought I found my niche in life. Because I love dogs. Dogs like me. Sort of an intellectual level. We went out and I see a dog and all I do is go, "Hee, little dog, hee, hee." And he's up in my arms, wagging his tail, licking me on the face. And I said, "We going for a ride." I put him in the truck. Ain't long till I got a truckload of dogs and we went out to the pound and he backed that truck up to this great big cage and put all them dogs in the cage and I went right in with them. Gave him some water and something to eat, and this guy, the dog catcher, come up and give me a bucket of paint. It had one of them stencil brushes in it. And he said, "Charlie, take this paint now and daub some high up on the dog's neck so he can't lick it off. Every one of them new ones you put in." I said, "For what?" He said, "Well," he said, "that's how we tell how long they've been here." He said, "We daub different color paint on them, and the one that's been here over 2 weeks, we shoot them." I said, "Shoot them? You mean to tell me I've been out here in my own hometown picking up these nice little dogs? They can't even make a phone call. And you're going to keep them 2 weeks and then shoot them?" He looked at me like I'm some new kind of nut. He said, what do you think we're doing, just collecting dogs? He had to go to some other part of the pound for something, and he oughtn't have done it. You way ahead of me, ain't you? Soon as he's out of sight, I open that gate and let all the dogs go. I mean, the black ones, the white ones, the red ones, and it didn't make no difference what color. I let them all go, and he come back, and ain't nobody there but me and a little old lady dog that won't go. And I'm saying, shoot, shoot, get, go. He said, what have you done? Turn all kind of colors. I said, I have turned your dogs loose. I said, I'm a drunk. I ain't no murderer. Oh, he was fit to be tied. Took me back down to police headquarters and charged me with highway mopery, attempt to creep or something. And they sent me to the county farm with some more time. And from then on, I did my time out on the county farm. It was a hard time out on that county farm. It was just like it said, it was a farm, and old Captain Todd Hunter was the boss, and when you did something that was wrong, he used that hide on you, and it hurt. And you know, some of us drunks like to be macho, tough, and we like to put on this front. This facade of toughness. And that was the kind of guy, the kind of drunk I was. I would go out that farm and I'd be tough. But at night, when they'd lock me in that bullpen with the rest of them peckerwoods, I'd turn my head to the mattress and cover my head up with a blanket or pillow, if one was available, so they couldn't hear me cry. I wanted to be home. I wanted to be free. Never occurred to me that I could quit drinking and this would be possible. Nobody never had come to me. This type of existence went on until I got to the point where they let me come home, but they wouldn't let me carry a key to the front door. And I'd come home about drunk, go up on the front porch, knock on my own door to get in my own house. And some member of my family would come and open the door just a little bit and say, yeah. I said, what do you mean, yes? I live here. Yeah, but you're drunk. Of course I'm drunk. If I ain't drunk, I wasted a lot of money on whiskey. Now let me in the house. And I'd go in and push my way back to that little room that was allotted to me, sitting in the corner of the house. And I'd swagger in there and slam that door and sit down on the side of the bed and cry. Because I wanted more than anything in the world to walk out into that house and put my arms around my mother and tell her with all the sincerity in the world that I loved her and I was ashamed. And I wasn't going to do that anymore. I wasn't going to bring embarrassment down on my family and shame. And my mother would be out there. The door would be closed, and it might just as well be a steel door with a half a dozen locks on it. Because I couldn't force myself to get up off of that bed and open that door and go out and embrace my mother. Because I knew the minute that I walked out that door, some member of my family would say, Charles, why do you do this? Why do you act this way? You were raised better than this, and I couldn't face that. I couldn't face the truth. I didn't know that I had a disease called alcoholism. And I didn't know that I couldn't help being what I was. I want to tell you non-alcoholic something. You heard some mighty good people talk. You heard some mighty good talks up to now. You heard Al-Anons talk about how they were hurt. That's true. Every one of us alcoholics know this. We know that we have hurt you. We know we've caused you a lot of trouble. But I want to tell you, Al-Anon, something right now. Damn if you didn't cause us a lot of trouble, too. I want you to know another thing. That when your drunken spouse came to you with bloodshot eyes and said to you, "I'm sorry, I'm going to stop hurting you and I'm not going to do this anymore," I want you to know that they meant that with every drop of blood and every bone and every piece of marrow and sinew in their body. They meant that even more than you prayed that they would. And the next time your drunken spouse came home and told you the same thing, he meant that with every bone and every drop of blood and every piece of marrow and sinew in his body. And today your sober spouse can't explain to you why in the name of God he did that. There's no explanation for it. And there's where faith comes in. We alcoholics have got to have faith in a power greater than ourselves, and you've got to have faith in us. We've got to have faith in you. You ever notice that nearly every alcoholic man that talks has lost a wife? I'm no exception. I lost 4 or 5 wives. And I don't know how many light housekeepers. I loved every one of them. And I love my present Liz. Liz, stand up and let these folks see. She's pretty as a picture. There you are, there's Liz. And she believes me, and she believes in me. And Liz is an alcoholic, and I believe in her. And I believe in her sincerity. And I believe that in time to come there's going to be difficulty. And I believe that I'll have strength enough to face whatever problems. And I know she can because she's already put up with me. And this is all it takes. A little courage to admit that you are capable of love. Remember when you didn't think that you had the capacity for love? I hated everybody and wished there was more of them. Finally, I got to the point in my drinking career where I wore long-handle underwear winter and summer. And in the summertime, I dropped the flaps for ventilation. Of course, I was smart. All alcoholics are smart. And I remember that when company would come, they would open the door where I was, to my little room,
just a little bit, say, "Don't come out, we got company." And close the door. That's just like waving a flag at a bull. I'd get a hold of my jug by its ear, come out, flap, flapping. Greet the company in a true southern gentlemanly manner. Invite them to have a drink. Tell them a couple of jokes I'd heard under the bridge. And wonder why they didn't have no sense of humor. Go back to my room. You ever wonder why it was sometime when you were at the very nadir? Did you know that our book, our big book, don't call it a bottom. It says nadir, N-A-D-I-R. Look that up in the dictionary, and nadir is the opposite to zenith. That's the bottom. And even at this point, this low point, I hadn't reached bottom. I had to go further. And it was long about this time that my family had a meeting to which I was not invited. Anytime your family has a meeting and you ain't invited to it, it's about you. And after the meeting, my cousin Alt, who was big and rough and tough, and had a habit of shaking folks. I don't mean just like that. He was up and around the room with you. Teeth scattered off out across the floor. Shoes running off. And he had done that to me a time or two. And when he said, "Hey, Charlie, come out here." I said, "Yeah." And I come out. I said, "What?" He said, "We just had a meeting." I said, "Did?" He said, "Yes, and it was about you." I said, "What?" He said, "Yes, and we decided you are nuts." I said, "Am." He said, "Yes, and we're going to send you to a psychiatrist." I said, "Are." He said, "Yes, and if you don't go, we're going to bug you." And I said, "What is his name and when do I go?" Well, they sent me to the nicest looking little fella you ever want to see in your life. He was clean and he had them nice little blue eyes, them pale blue eyes. And he just smiled, and the minute I looked at him, I said, "I got a responsibility. I got to take care of this man." Because you could look at him and tell that his bread wasn't brown on both sides. And he asked the weirdest questions you ever heard of. I mean, he asked questions like, "Did you ever have DTs?" I said, "I had them when they first come out." He said things like, "Now, I said, I want you to give me a rundown on your day." I said, "Like what?" He said, "Tell me what transpires in your thinking processes and what manifests itself therefrom." I said, "Run that by me one more time." "You done missed me altogether." He said, "When you get up in the morning, you do something." I said, "Yes." I said, "You want to know what do I do when I first get up in the morning?" He said, "Yes," and I told him. And that wasn't what he wanted to know. Communication done broke down. He said, when you wake up, you do something, and when you get through doing that, you do something else, and you get through, and so on through the day. I said, "Why don't you say it in the first place? Come on, where that manifests itself." I said to myself, I said, "Now, this old boy's about to leave the limb." And see, he was my first patient.
And I said, my day and his day do not parallel. And I thought this thing over. I said, I got to be careful. And I said, well, the first thing I do when I wake up is open my eyes. And knowing him as I did, I explained why. I said, the reason I do this is to see where I wound up. And damn if I didn't have to explain that. See, he woke up in the same place every morning. I never knew where I was going to wind up. I said, then after I wake up and look around the room, if it's a room, I said, and I determine where I am. I sit up on the side of the bed, if it's a bed, and scratch and belch and light a cigarette and vomit. And he said, vomit? I said, certainly, man, everybody does that. And he did not know it. He did not know that all drunks wake up and throw up. He didn't know that. Well, visits kept on, and see, when we get to a point like that, his face would turn real red, and he'd get to trembling, and I'd slack off, because I didn't want to lose him. See, with these people, you develop a sort of a paternal feeling for, you know. You feel like picking them up and carrying them over and changing them or something like that, you know. Rubbing them and do something with them. And he said, now, this was at a later visit. He said, now today we're going to go into your childhood. I said, go ahead. You've been everywhere else. He said, as a child, did you wet the bed? I said, still do. Took a while, you know, for him to settle down after that. When he got his voice back, he said, did you pick your nose? I said, when it needed it. Well, he turned red, got to shaking. And you know how it is when you're talking to somebody and they're nervous. You get nervous too. And I took a little black ball and I rubbed it around in my hand. Calmed me right down. He couldn't keep his eye off of me rubbing that little black ball around on my hand. Finally, he said, why are you rubbing that little black ball around on your hand? I said, you ain't the easiest man in the world to talk to today, and this kind of soothes my nerves. By this time, I'm calm as a cucumber. He said, do you mind if I try it? I said, certainly. I handed him the little black ball. He rubbed it around on his hand. Pretty soon, big grin come on his face. He said, it does soothe your nerves, don't it? I said, indeed it do. He said, where did you get it? I told him. I said, out of my nose. Well, That was just before they sent me to the nut house. Me and him both. I got out. He never made it. He just kind of drifted off into limbo. But you know, when you go to a psychiatrist, he treats your disease to the best of his ability. When you go to a physician, a medical doctor, an internist, or just ordinary family doctor, he treats your disease to the best of his ability. And when you go to the man in the man of the cloth, minister, he treats your disease to the best of his ability. But it only seems a little ridiculous to send a drunk to your preacher. He don't know nothing about drinking. Ain't supposed to. Although there are a lot of alcoholic preachers. But if you think that your preacher is the place to send a drunk, next time you see him, you say, "Reverend, how long has it been since you chinned yourself on a commode?" He may not even know what you're talking about. But you do. Well, I ain't gonna quit. I got another story to tell you. See, I haven't even got an AA yet. See, what I do when I'm asked to go somewhere and talk, I just talk till the time's up and quit. And sometimes it don't make no sense at all to me or you or anybody else. See, my story is so long, I haven't heard it all myself. And I make what is known as an extemporaneous talk. That means you just talk hoping you say something. And I know that there's somebody out there, and I don't know where you are or who you are. I don't know even if you're in this building, but maybe on one of those tapes back there, there'll be somebody somewhere that'll listen to what I say, and some part of it will make sense to them, and they'll find their way into this blessed fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I didn't join AA. I was just kicked out of everything else and wound up in AA. I'm what they call a low-bottom drunk. Jails, skid row, boxcar, begging, bumming, stealing, all the things that go with what constitutes the low-bottom male alcoholic during a depression. And there's not a whole lot of difference now. Maybe you don't get out on the street and bum the citizens, but you're a bum at home. I want to ask you folks that are members of Alcoholics Anonymous in your own heart. And you read the book. And you read how it tells you to share your experience, your strength, and your hope with other alcoholics. If you were arrested and accused of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, would you be convicted? Or would you be able to talk your way out of it? Or would you feel like it was necessary for you to? You know what anonymity means in the true light of Alcoholics Anonymous definition?
which is spiritual anonymity. Spiritual anonymity means that you're willing to serve your fellow man without any thought of compensation or recognition. It don't mean that you come into Alcoholics Anonymous and get an unlisted telephone number and tell somebody your name is Joel P. That's a cop-out, ain't it? In the book, Dr. Bob and the Old-Timers, it explains this very clearly. It says that the traditions tell you explicitly that anonymity is at the level of press, radio, and the news media, TV. When you're in an Alcoholics Anonymous environment, you're supposed to let people know who you are and how they can get a hold of you. Else, how could you be of service? And the word service is one of the three on the triangle. I'm not trying to give you a guilt feeling. I'm not trying to make you feel guilty. I just want you to know that you're important to the next drunk that walks through that door. Wherever your group may be, someday you're going to be sitting there and somebody's going to come in and you're going to see people turn their head because he stinks. Because he hadn't got all his teeth. Because he hadn't got a comb to comb his hair or a clean shirt. Are you going to turn your head? Or are you going to go over and practice that crooked arm therapy? Are you going to go over and stick out your hand and pull him to you and put your arm around him and say, come, go with me, and we will do this together? That's what Alcoholics Anonymous philosophy is all about. Somebody loves you enough to care enough about you to take time to tell you, come, go with me, and we will do this together. They didn't ask you if you were a Christian or a Jew, Catholic or Protestant, divorced or married. There's not a man or woman in this room or any other AA environment tonight who brought a petition signed by two people that would guarantee your conduct. You came here because you were wrong. And you're here because you want to get right. I came to AA in 1940. And I hadn't had a drink of any alcoholic beverage since May 15th, 1945. That's over 40 years. But I need you tonight just as desperately as I needed you when I wandered into AA, and I wasn't out of teeth, but I was down to two. I had two teeth and they didn't match. There was one up here and one down here. And I loved them little Spanish peanuts. Did you ever try to eat a Spanish peanut with just two teeth? It'd take about 50 clicks. And that ain't counting the time you miss him altogether. I used to go to them matinees and get me a dime's worth of Spanish peanuts and a half pint of whiskey. And I would sit there watching that movie. And you know how you can project your personality on the screen when you're watching a movie? If it was one of them hero-type movies. You know, like the town is burning and it's surrounded by fire. And if somebody don't back that locomotive in there with a couple of boxcars, they're all going to burn to death and perish. And he asked for volunteers. I'll go. Man, and on in that screen, you watch that man up at that throttle and that engine going, and that's you. You go back in there and save all them people, come out, and your skin is singed, all black. And you projected your personality on it, and you're clicking on them peanuts. Click, 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 click. And if it's one of them war pictures, you know, where there's the good side and the bad side and the good general and the bad general, you think that you'd be one of them thousands of privates out there firing them guns and getting shot? No. Uh-uh. General Lindenwood. On the good side. And then if it was one of them romantic pictures, and the love scene comes up, and you projecting your image right there on the screen. You know, it takes a love or and a love E. You be the love or. And then is when your imagination snaps. You can't stretch it no further. Because you know as well as anything in the world that there ain't no demand for a two-tooth lover. You know that. And even if you could find a two-tooth lovey, still wouldn't work. Because it'd be dangerous. You're liable to cut yourself all to pieces. But you remember these things that happened. I'm going to wind this thing up now. I do want you to know that I loved AA. And I do want you to know that they were interested in me. And they loved me enough to tell me my faults. There was one guy in particular that used to tell me when I was wrong. He was always telling me, you're going down the wrong road. Come on back and do this and that. I hated him. I wanted to be coddled. I wanted to be petted, and I wanted to be told that I was doing right and I was doing good. But old Doug Halley loved me enough that he wanted to tell me what I needed to hear, not what I wanted to hear. And they used to tell people, keep on drinking, you'll be like Charlie. One guy told me, he said, boy, you are double dumb. I said, how can you be double dumb? He said, you ignorant of the fact that you're ignorant. You know how it is when you first come in AA and you feel that glow of growth, and you feel like, man, you've got this thing whipped. And I guess I've been sober about a week. And there was three new guys coming there. And I was telling them, be like me. Don't live in the flop house. Get you a job. I done had a job making $7 a week washing dishes. Part time. And I had moved out of the flop house into a $3 a week hall room with a chair painted on the wall. And I was telling these folks, get your job. Get your place to live. Don't be what they read about in the paper of no fixed address. And about this time, this old boy gave me this crooked finger move, and he said, I went over and he said, Charlie, this may come as a big, big surprise to you, but them boys you're talking to never have got down to where you got up to. Well, no matter what happened and what kept happening, I stayed with AA from May 15th, 1945. Now, I already told you I came in 1940. What happened between October, around October 1940, and May 15th, 1945. I kept recovering. I kept getting well. Every time I'd get sober and the dog would quit growling when I come in, I'd get a job, boss liked me, I didn't get no more fights. I was a cantankerous drunk, argumentative. I remember one time I was arguing with a guy and I said to him, "Did you tell so-and-so I was a SOB? He said, "No, I don't know how he found out." You remember at the beginning of this, I told you there was love in this room? And you remember how you looked around and you told somebody you loved them? I remember when I first came in AA, and I was sitting there right on the front row amongst the incurables. And this guy had brought me in and set me down right next to the cleanest looking little guy you ever seen in your life. He was so clean, he just shined. And I was sitting there sweating, stinking, and belching, making other noises commensurate to alcoholics with gastritis. And this little fella looked at me, and you could see how uncomfortable he was. And you could just hear the thoughts going on in his head, like, "Oh, God, this man needs AA more than anybody I ever seen. And I can't say something to him like, why don't you take a bath?" And Lord, he thought for the longest time, and finally he come up with a solution. He reached his hand in his shirt pocket and he pulled out his cigarette and he thumped it. Boom, boom, boom. And you know how that little pyramid of cigarette shoots out there? He said, "Have one." I took two. I offered him that extra one back, but it was done contaminated. He said, "Keep it." I put it in my shirt. He reached in his jacket pocket and got a lighter and lit my cigarette. And then he lit his own. And then he moved over and put an ashtray in between us. And he said, "We'll both use this." You know what happened? Love. Love. Love at work. And I knew it, and I felt it. I knew that this man was giving me respect that I had not earned. He was treating me like I was somebody, and I knew I wasn't. He was treating me like I was one of God's children, and I didn't think that was possible. And that man sat there beside me all through this meeting, and after the meeting, he came over to me and shook my hand, and he said, "Come back." And maybe that's the two most important words I ever heard. Come back. Come back. And I left there with 50 cents of his money to pay for my flop for that night down on 9th Street in Washington, D.C. Another fellow talked to me till the club closed up. Talked with me, not at me. There's a difference in being talked at and being talked with. And he understood me, I understood him. We talked about being locked up, and we talked about being in insane asylums, and we talked about being lonely, and we talked about being hurt. We talked about unjustified anger and what to do about it. And when it was time to go, he said, I've got to get up in the morning and go to work. But he said, here's two car tokens. Use one of these to get down to 9th and E. Keep the other one in your pocket and come back here in the morning and I'll meet you here at 9 o'clock. I went out and got on that streetcar and I sat up straight. They had told me that I was a member of AA. You know how it is when somebody congratulates you just for being sober, just for doing what you ought to have been doing all the time, and you don't quite understand it? You're too new in the program. You remember that. I came back the next morning, and I thought that must have been a nightmare. I told you I just had two teeth, one up here and one down here. And at that time, as weird as my thinking was, I thought just having one top tooth was a social advantage. And I guess it is. You know, there ain't no way in the world you can grin at somebody with just one tooth and they don't grin back. I climbed up that long flight of stairs and I looked down at myself. My shoes were relievers, dirty. My pants were ventilated. I looked at my old overcoat that I had on. I'd been sleeping in it. I was rooming in it, actually. I had on my worldly possessions. And as I took a step up, I said to myself, oh, boy, you're crazy. Nobody in that room wants you to come back. The nice, clean people don't want you. And I turned around to leave. And just as I turned around, I believe that God in His infinite wisdom gave me one of my many spiritual awakenings. Because I heard just as clearly and distinctly as if someone were speaking to me, boy, you better go up to those people. Because if anybody's going to lose, it's got to be them. You don't have anything else left to lose. And I walked up those steps. I stuck my head in the door, and I grinned with that one tooth. And those guys, there was about six of them in that room, and one guy looked out there and saw me, and he said to these other fellows, there he is. I told you he'd be here. That's Charlie. He's betting on me. And I'm glad he won. One guy came over to me and he said, boy, do you think you can hold a cup of coffee on your stomach? I don't want to have to mop this floor. I understood that. I said, yes, sir. One guy came over and gave me some shoes. He said, here, take off them old wet shoes and put these on. Go over and put your feet up on that radiator and get them dry. It must be freezing. I did. He regretted it. I don't think they've asked anybody since in Washington, D.C. to put their feet on a radiator. One guy came over and handed me a shirt. They put this on. Give me yours. I had discarded my underwear for obvious reasons. Guy came over and he said, boy, please give me that coat. I'll get you another one. He got me a nice top coat. I was home. But I was sick. And I wasn't up to shaking yet. I was jittery. You know how you tremble. And I sat down on a chair. Now, it's been more than 24 hours since I had a drink. I'm sitting on a chair and I'm quivering. And a guy, great big, tough-looking guy come over and looked down at me and says, boy, you're doing a wonderful job. I said, you're crazy. I'm dying. I said, I'm going to die now. He said, no, if you're going to die, you died yesterday. He said, you're doing all right. He said, I want to tell you something else. He looked at, towered over me greatly. He said, I love you. I said, I'm married. That's universal love. Compassionate love at work. That's love. And I love you. God bless you.